much more within reach to almost everyone I knew. What little responsibility I took was in acknowledging that there were times I probably could have had sex with someone and neglected to take the steps necessary to find out. Let's say a mousetrap had consciousness, and it lay down somewhere very few mice like to go, maybe the middle of a very busy sidewalk. Then let's say that on the rare occasion a mouse did come close enough, instead of snapping its silver arm down across its back, the mousetrap was like, I'll get the next one. Then the mousetrap would feel very bad for itself for a while. It was kind of like that. My mother has always told me I have to say no to something several times before I'll say yes to it, and though I do not think she'd love to hear that rule applied to sex, it fits there too. Even at 27, and by then thoroughly fed up with myself, I was still hesitating. That year I had more clear, unobscured, inarguable opportunities to have sex than I'd ever had, and I'd rejected every one. I had my reasons. He was too drunk. I had a thing early the next morning. I was waiting for the third date. But at the root of it, very deep down, there was a growing suspicion I didn't know what to do with. That perhaps I had not had sex with these men simply because I did not want to. And if I did not want to have sex with men I had allegedly liked for months before I got in their beds, I did not know what men I would want to have sex with. Toward the end of what turned out to be our truly perfect second date, Lydia asked if I'd slept with a girl before, and I said no. I'd already told her I hadn't been out with a girl before, so I was a little annoyed that she kept making me state my inexperience in different ways, but I was too high on adrenaline to do anything else but continue confessing. We'd been making out on a boardwalk bench in that urgent sort of way that forces the issue of sex, which was a way I'd never really made out with anyone before. I was sitting slumped far enough down into my seat so that she, 5 inches shorter, could put her arm around my shoulder and I could rest my head on hers. While I answered her questions, I was looking at the ocean instead of her. But each time she was like, oh, okay. And when I did look at her, I could tell it really wasn't a big deal. She was unfazed, if a little surprised. Maybe it's that queer people are more familiar with atypical timelines and being someone's first. Maybe this woman was special. After a couple more very good dates and a lot more excellent making out, we picked an upcoming night to be the first time she slept over, a not very euphemistic euphemism for the first time we'd, you know, do it. That night, my roommate and I were having a party, and it was still well underway when Lydia and I, both of us a bit drunk, tired, antsy, having known all day what would eventually happen, decided we'd had enough waiting. He retreated into my room at the opposite end of the apartment from the remaining partiers and closed the door and locked it, or so I thought. When someone opened my bedroom door 5 or 10 minutes later, it was, visually speaking, the worst possible time. I do not know why someone opened my door, apart from alcohol-induced confusion or a mistaken belief that this was where they'd left their coat, nor do I know who it was because my eyes were closed and I hoped to die without finding out. No sooner had we heard the creak of the door opening than Lydia's foot shot backwards, slamming it closed. She played Division I soccer in college and has the reflexes to prove it. Oh my God, I said. Who was that? I don't know. Do you think they saw? I don't know, said Lydia in a way that clearly meant, yes, probably. Maybe our unintentional pervert was looking over his or her shoulder when they twisted the knob and pressed the door open. Maybe, thanks to Lydia's athleticism, they didn't see anything. But probably they did. And while that was embarrassing and imperfect and so different from the way I'd imagined it in my head, it was also comfortable and natural and nice. It was good enough to know it was right. And I knew, I could already tell, that it was only going to get better. Chapter 9, Harry and Me. The last boys I fell in love with were actually young enough to deserve the term boys. I am speaking, of course, of the former boy band and international sensation One Direction. 1D mania hit me a little late in several senses of the word. For one, I was 26 years old. For another, they'd been around for 2 years already. While I'd been aware of the band's existence and was halfway familiar with their origin story as a supergroup manufactured by Simon Cowell, I was not, by any stretch, a fan. I wasn't much for boy bands during the time period in my life in which it is socially sanctioned for girls to be obsessed with boy bands. When pressed, I could pick a favorite Hanson brother, Taylor. NSYNC was fine. The Backstreet Boys were fine. 98 Degrees was hilarious. I owned most of these albums and liked them well enough, but my interest ended when I turned my Discman off. I didn't have t-shirts or posters. I didn't collect magazine cutouts and tape them to my walls. I never went to any of their concerts. I didn't know, like, trivia. I knew which band member I believed to be the cute one in each case, but even then it was more a necessary rite of passage than a passion. For a time I considered myself a J.C. Chazet girl, and finding others who felt the same way provided me with, if not actual friends, a few moments of pleasant small talk. But I did not care about any of these bands as entities. I did not suffer when they broke up. If every woman is born with a reserve of manic fangirl enthusiasm, mine survived my adolescence untapped. And then, One Direction. I was aware of the band before I went crazy for them, but only as a group of teenagers who sang that song about how hot girls don't need to wear makeup because they're already hot. Then 2 years went by, and the band released their second album, and something amazing happened right around that same time. They grew up. For someone my age, it would have been a little bit inappropriate to fawn over One Direction in their first couple of years. They were teenagers, and obvious ones. One of them, Niall, the Irish one, had braces. Then they grew up just enough to stop plastering their hair across their foreheads. Most of them were at least 20 by 2013, except for Harry, who I learned was 19 years old. Having just seen the video for Best Song Ever for the first time, I decided I didn't care. He was the most beautiful boy I had ever seen in my life. A few months later, when our friend from work, Matt, mentioned he had two extra tickets to the One Direction show at MetLife Stadium that summer, my friend Ariana and I decided to go. At that time, we were low-level fans only. I'd downloaded only their two newest singles, and while I thought that Harry Styles was very cute, I was satisfied by seeing a handful of red carpet photos of him and the others every couple of months. The main reason we decided to pay $125 to go to New Jersey to see a preteens band was because we thought it would be funny. And it was. Matt designed us matching t-shirts to wear, a collage of Harry's faces in the shape of a heart, with the message, "Harry Styles come to BuzzFeed," underneath. We found our seats way up high and looked all around at the sea of girls, most of them under the age of 15, and their parents. We decided to get beers, and there was no line at all, anywhere, because so few people there were over 21. Before the show started, the speakers blasted a playlist clearly meant to be retro and hip, and all of it was the music that was cool when I was 13. When the band came on stage, we screamed. Ariana and I didn't know most of the songs, but we sang along to those we did. I took dozens of terrible, blurry photos, and just one or two in which Harry's face was clearly visible from the big screen projection at the back of the stage. This was during his head wrap phase. He was just then starting to grow out his hair. It is probably not a coincidence that my love for One Direction grew in direct proportion to the length of Harry Styles' hair. When I left that first show, I was entertained, but not yet a full-on fangirl. That came a few months later, in September, when the boys, that's what I started calling them, the boys, a telltale sign that one has crossed over, released the first single off their new album, Steal My Girl. Soon after that, they released the video, in which Harry Styles wears a leopard print trench coat, his shoulder-length hair flowing in the wind. From then on, I was a goner. Harry Styles was the only man that mattered. I became friends with other diehard 1B fans somewhat automatically. We were drawn to one another like starry-eyed magnets. These were the girls in my office who huddled around the newsroom TVs when the boys appeared on a morning talk show, who tweeted hard-eyes emojis alongside pictures of Zayn's hair curl at the 2014 AMAs, who instant messaged one another photos of their every red carpet appearance and photo spread. 3 months after we first saw them in concert, a group of us bought tickets for their next New York and New Jersey show, 11 months in advance. At the height of my 1D mania, my equally obsessed friend Mackenzie and I texted back and forth about them almost hourly. For a month that winter, I was on book leave from work, staying at my parents' house in Minnesota. In the mornings, I wrote and edited my manuscript from the armchair in the living room, and every afternoon, all afternoon, I read books and texted about Harry Styles. We debated the merits of the feathered hat phase and then the heeled boots one. We kept a ranking of our favorite ever Harry looks. We examined paparazzi photos of him with rumored girlfriends and dissected Tumblr fan theories about him and Taylor Swift. Never in my life have I been so obsessed with a celebrity, or anyone for that matter. No level of trivia was irrelevant. No number of slightly different photos from the same event was too many. Everything that was available I had to consume. I watched the band's documentary, This Is Us, twice, and I finally sympathized with the kind of girl who could be seen sobbing, reaching, trying to attach herself to the tour bus in hopes that she will be plucked from the crowd, carried away to be both fan in residence and Harry Styles' wife. There were a few times that year when Harry Styles came to New York City. That's how I learned that being a super fan of a celebrity is a very different story when you live in a major city. When I lived in Minnesota, I felt equal proximity to every celebrity, which is to say, about the distance from me to the moon. Generally speaking, Minnesota is not a place that celebrities who are not from Minnesota ever come to. I never knew what it was like to come across pictures of one at a restaurant or shop and go, "Oh my God, I was just there!" But celebrities are in New York all the time. A whole bunch of them live here. It is absurd to me that I live in the same city as Taylor Swift, and I don't even have strong feelings about Taylor Swift. When I see a celebrity, and honestly, it can be anyone, I invariably freeze up like an iguana trying to blend into its background. I don't want to be witnessed seeing a celebrity because I am positive that any celebrity who did see me looking would be able to tell that I am not cool. And having a celebrity I think is cool think that I'm a loser is too devastating a possibility for me to bear. So when Harry Styles came to New York, I was constantly on edge. I'm normally not a person who experiences much FOMO, but with him even nominally nearby, my levels were through the roof. Physical proximity lowered the otherwise insurmountable mountain of difference between us just enough to make me feel vaguely but defiantly optimistic that we could not only meet, but get along. Sure, he was internationally famous and a multimillionaire and otherworldly handsome and 7 years my junior, among other complicating factors. But most of the time, he was all that plus an ocean or more away. When he came to New York for 5 or 10 days at a time, he was still all that, but we were in the same place. Geographically, there was at least a chance we could meet. In a city of 8.4 million people, I became convinced I would run into him on the sidewalk with no one else around us. Here's how it would happen. I'd turn the corner onto a quiet street around sunset, looking at my phone. I'd look up to make sure I wasn't about to run into anyone, and then I'd look back at my phone. But then, wait, I'd look up again. Is that who I think? Way down at the other end of the street? No. I'd stop walking for a second, but only a second, because it would look weird if I froze for too long. We'd get close enough to each other to see each other and smile. He would see that I recognized him and would appreciate how chill I was being about it. "Excuse me," he'd say. "Which way is Allen Street?" Then there would be some stuff about directions and this weird art thing he was trying to find because he had told a friend he'd go to it but really didn't want to go. I would say, "Hey, that's not far from my favorite ice cream place." He would say, "Ice cream sounds so much better than art right now." Then at some point after that, he hugs me and picks me up and carries me over a threshold. I never worked out how we got to the ice cream place or where the threshold was or what was on the other side of it. That part didn't really matter. All I wanted was for him to hug me and then pick me up. I wanted to meet him so bad it made me nauseated. Being at my desk at work during these visits was intolerable. Mackenzie and I would instant message back and forth all day, sending links to pictures we'd found online of other, more blessed New Yorkers who'd run into Harry, our Harry, outside Veselka, or at the Met, or outside the Saint Laurent on Green Street. Knowing he was that close, walking down streets I walked down all the time, while precious hours of possibility slipped away as I sat trapped at my desk, was torturous. At the beginning of every trip he made to New York, I felt so bright and full of hope, and by the end of every trip, I was worn out, depressed, and deeply embarrassed. Mackenzie and I started saying we didn't want him to come to New York anymore, and we were only half-joking. It was simply too stressful. But before we decided the best policy was to deliberately ignore Harry's presence in New York, we went to wait for him outside his hotel. In my defense, I'd had one prior experience that gave me reason to believe it could be that simple. Once, in the summer of 2006, my friends and I decided to go look for Lindsay Lohan in downtown St. Paul, where she was on location for the film A Prairie Home Companion. Miracle of miracles, we actually found her, smoking a cigarette on the sidewalk outside her trailer. But that's a story for another time. In Mackenzie's defense, let me make clear that this pursuit was largely my idea. Yes, she had a pretty good idea as to where Harry was staying, thanks to fan Twitter intel from previous visits, and a working knowledge on her part of the finer, chicer New York City hotels. And yes, she could be talked into dropping by with me, but the responsibility for our loitering lies with me. I talked her into it. I said, it's fine. We'll just stand there for 2 seconds, just to see. She had some reservations about participating in what could fairly be called light stalking. I did not. It wasn't like I planned to try to get inside or even talk to him. All I wanted was to stand on the sidewalk, 20 or 30 feet away from the hotel entrance, and see Harry either leave or return. Sure, in a dream world, maybe he'd wave. Blow a kiss. But I felt strongly that just seeing him would be enough. My One Direction fever would be broken, and I could return to a level of interest befitting an almost 30-year-old woman. So Mackenzie and I left work around 6, walked out into a light rain, and headed south down Fifth Avenue. On the way there, under my umbrella, we worried aloud about the boys. There was, by then, a vague sense that things might not continue on forever as they had. Most of the boys were staying at separate hotels when they toured, and video clips from their performances from the European leg showed them listless, distracted. Together, we tried to prepare ourselves for the timeline ahead. The boys would record a 5th album, and then tour it, and then, probably, they'd be done. We thought this was more than reasonable. As adult fans, we knew better than the teens who seemed to believe One Direction was incombustible and permanent. We'd seen the end of the Spice Girls and NSYNC. We knew that nothing this beautiful and perfect could last. But that night, that spring when Harry's hair was long but not yet too long, we were still hopeful. And when we rounded the corner onto West 3rd Street and the Bowery Hotel came into view, my heart leapt into my throat. The first thing I noticed was that we were not alone in our pursuit. This was not Minnesota. This was much bigger than Lindsay Lohan. Outside the entrance to the hotel, there were 4 other clusters of girls that I could see, and we figured there were probably more around back. They huddled in smaller groups of 2 and 3 and 4, some under umbrellas and some, more brave, sidled up alongside the building under the overhang. 2 teenage girls were seated on a bench under a trellis, working on their laptops. Oh my God, I thought. They are doing homework. As for Mackenzie and I, we stood as close as she was willing to go and as far away as I was willing to tolerate, about 20 yards. Without acknowledging what we were doing, we both pretended, on and off, to be looking up directions on our phones. I looked up now and again to watch hotel security watching the other girls, and each time a black car pulled up to the curb, I watched all 10 or 12 of them freeze in place, their eyes glued to the back door. But it was never Harry who came out, and as soon as we accepted that, we resumed our collective charade. After 15 minutes or so, Mackenzie said we should go, but I negotiated her up to another 15. Just think how we'll feel if we leave and find out he came out 10 minutes later and hugged everybody, I said. A few minutes later, one of the clusters of girls abruptly walked around the corner to the side of the hotel. Then another group did. Something's happening, I said. Mackenzie and I stood there watching the other girls disappear. And then we panicked. What should we do? I don't know, said Mackenzie. Should we follow them? Where did they even go? Maybe they know something we don't. Maybe he's coming out to say hi, said Mackenzie. I just about fainted. Oh my God, really? I gasped. It was like I never heard the maybe. Harry Styles was coming out to say hi. To us. Maybe, she repeated. Like his manager could come out first and be like, you know, keep it cool, the 10 of you can get a photo, but then you gotta go. I know it's definitely happened before. I thought this made a lot of sense. Because we showed up and waited politely, we were going to be rewarded with meeting Harry Styles. As we rounded the corner, my body started to shake. I imagined him coming out the side of the building, smiling at the line of girls waiting to see him. I imagined my turn and what I might say. I tried to plan a joke in advance, which is nearly impossible in the most optimal of circumstances. You can have it all mapped out, but rarely will the other person supply the setup your punchline requires, particularly when that person is a famous celebrity who doesn't know or care who you are. Still, I wanted to make an impact. I thought maybe I'd joke that we'd lined up not knowing what we were in line for. Something like, oh, we were just walking by and saw a line and thought maybe someone was giving away free food. I know that doesn't sound all that funny, but I was counting on my delivery to make it work. Once we saw the other girls standing around what looked like a side entrance to the hotel, I lost whatever remaining shred of cool I had left. I texted Ariana to tell her I was about to meet Harry Styles, and she texted me back to say that if I met Harry Styles without her, she would have to end our friendship. I was not insulted because I felt the same way. Maintaining a relationship under those conditions would be intolerable. "When do you think he'll come out?" I asked Mackenzie. She shrugged. I was both impressed and annoyed by her blasé demeanor because I knew she was just as excited at the prospect of meeting Harry Styles as I was, if not more so. She was just better at not getting her hopes up. She refused to stand there staring at the door, so I stared at it for the both of us. 10 or 15 minutes passed and nothing happened. Then, one of the little groups of girls got up from their perch on a tree planter, wiped their hands across the backs of their jean shorts, and walked away. That they did so decisively gave me pause, but I comforted myself by telling myself that those four girls just made the biggest mistake of their lives. Then another group left, too. All that remained were me, Mackenzie, and a group of teenagers waiting across the street. "What should we do?" I asked. "I don't know," said Mackenzie. "I'm not sure it's happening." "I'm gonna ask those kids over there what's up," I said. Was I embarrassed by the prospect of approaching a group of teenagers as a 27-year-old woman to ask if they had any teenager-type intel into the whereabouts of my favorite boy band member? Yes, so embarrassed. But I wasn't quite as embarrassed as I was desperate. If I was going to have spent an evening waiting for Harry Styles outside his hotel, then I wanted it to have been worth it. I crossed the street toward the girls, and Mackenzie followed reluctantly behind. "Hi," I said. "Are you guys here because of Harry?" I whispered his name like it was a code word for drugs. "Yeah," one of them said, and it was then that I saw she had braces. "But we don't think he's here," said another. "At least not anymore." "Really?" "Yeah," said braces. "Someone who works at the hotel tweeted that he was here earlier, so he had to move." "Oh my God," I said. "That is so rude." "I know." I felt bad for Harry, but I felt even worse for me. "Well, thanks for the tip," I said. "No problem," said braces. "Can I ask how old you guys are?" I said. "I'm 16," she said. "They're 17. "Cool," I said. "I'm 27, and she's 24. I half expected the girls to laugh at us or throw up in shock, but they didn't. They got it. It was Harry Styles. "I think we're going to go try another hotel," said braces, and I nodded solemnly, as if to say, "Good luck and Godspeed." There was a part of me that wanted to follow them, but there was a bigger part that knew it was time for me to concede. Stopping by a hotel that was on the way home from work in search of a young and famous celebrity was one thing, but following a group of teenagers to a second location was quite another. I texted Ariana to let her know we hadn't met Harry after all, and she texted back her condolences along with some barely camouflaged relief. I was not especially lucky after all. Perhaps you are allotted only a single planned and executed celebrity encounter in your lifetime, and I had wasted mine on Lindsay Lohan. Less than a year after I loitered outside Harry Styles' hotel, One Direction began to fall apart. The news that Zayn had quit the band hit one morning when I was at work, and seconds after I saw the headline, a wailing chorus of "No!" rang out through the office, and Mackenzie full-on ran from her desk to mine. Once there, she collapsed on the floor and pressed her hands over her face. We'd been preparing for this. Zayn had left the tour 6 days earlier for a break, and before that had been skipping out on events and performances. But there is only so much you can do to get ready for something you don't really believe will happen. The longer I loved One Direction, the more dreamy and rosy-eyed I'd become. First I loved them winkingly, and then sincerely, and then obsessively. And before I knew it, their continued existence as an unbreakable unit was something I took for granted. I forgot to be cautious and cynical, and instead gave myself over to hoping for the impossible. And in that way, loving One Direction made me a teenager again. The night Zayn left the band, I looked up "Goodbye Zayn" type fan art on Tumblr. I found a drawing of Zayn hugging each of the other band members individually, their faces buried into his shoulder, their arms clasping his neck and back. Above them were written the words, "I love you so." I stared at this drawing and I sobbed my stupid teenage heart out. My One Direction mania hit me hardest at a time when I was otherwise plagued by pessimism and gloom. It had been over a year and a half since I dated anyone, and it was only getting harder for me to remember how I'd felt about those people, before they hurt me, and I decided I would hate them forever and never forgive them. My efforts, while admittedly modest, at meeting someone new, hadn't gotten me anywhere either. The last date I'd been on was with a guy I met on Tinder, and the main things we'd talked about were snuff films and his subway tunnel graffiti hobby. And this was the most appealing man I'd been able to find in months and months of swiping. I'd always known, or at least been told, I was picky, but finding only a handful of men attractive seemed like something beyond just choosiness. But I didn't know what that something was. All I knew was that of the men available to me, there was almost no one I wanted, and with every person I swiped into the metaphorical trash can, it got harder and harder to believe I'd find one I did. The more time that went by, the more looking for love felt like a chore I hated, like dusting window blinds. I did it because I knew I was supposed to, and I knew I wanted its abstract outcome, but I wasn't having any fun. Loving One Direction, though, that was fun. One Direction reminded me what it was like to like boys. Hand to heart, I swear I could get butterflies from looking at a gif of Harry Styles' dimples. It was a sensation I seemed able to get only from media. A gif, sure, or a movie, or a text or a G-chat from a guy I liked. But it had been years since I had felt that way about anyone in real life. Lately, when the opportunity for actual romance and actual sex presented itself, I found I no longer wanted it. For years I waited to kiss someone I actually truly liked, sure that then, finally, I'd feel the thing I was supposed to. The thing that was so conspicuously absent from every drunken makeout I'd participated in throughout college and the years afterward. But even when I finally did kiss the man I really and truly liked, I felt almost nothing. All that was there was the feeling I get when I achieve any task I set out to accomplish. That is to say, it definitely felt as good as transferring $100 to my savings account, but not any better. So maybe there really was something wrong with me. And on the worst days, when I couldn't stop worrying it was true, and my case was a hopeless one, and this was as good as it was going to get, I listened to One Direction. And for a while, I forgot about men and thought instead of the boys. The boys of 1D reminded me of the ones I liked when I was in high school and college, but they were even better because of the grooming and the professional stylists. Even better because they loved me as much as, no, more than, I loved them. This was the message of every last one of their songs. Through their sweepingly romantic, comfortingly cliched, and candy-sweet lyrics, I was able to access my otherwise closed-off heart. I could remember what it was like to ache for a boy I'd never met and never would. I have since learned that I am not the only gay girl to have a massive crush on Harry Styles. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that queer girls who are into Harry Styles is a definite thing. The first clue came in the form of a recent email from a 30-year-old gay woman who met her girlfriend through an informal but organized group of adult Harry Styles fans. Prior to dating each other, neither woman had dated women before, but both had loved Harry for a long time. I was intrigued. Not long ago, I did an audit of my queer friends at work and realized that at least three or four were or are obsessed with Harry, too. So were several of the queer women online whom I've made friends with based on shared queerness and interest in Harry Styles. One of them, Fran, has the same sad and zaneless One Direction calendar as me, and we both post pictures of it on the first of each month. Ruby Tando, the Out cookbook author and former Great British Bake Off contestant, is a professed fangirl. Jane Lynch has even talked about her crush on Harry, and she is both gay and 57 years old. It doesn't matter. Harry is perfect. He is for everyone. I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think Harry Styles has the power to make women realize they're queer, but that sounds bad. That sounds like the premise of a rom-com formed by cutting and pasting together scraps from the screenplays for Zhili and Good Luck Chuck. I do not mean Harry Styles is a turnoff so strong that the mere sight of him could turn a straight woman gay. Rather, I mean that his own boyish, beautiful androgyny has served as a linchpin for many young, and even youngish, women who grew up liking boys, but find themselves unable to muster the same adoration for most men. We see Harry, with his long curly hair, flowy silk shirts, his tight women's Page brand jeans, his stacked heel boots, and we think, I want that. We want him and his clothes. We want to hold him, and we want to be him. Harry Styles was one of my last and biggest stumbling blocks when it came to figuring out my sexuality. I thought, how can I like girls if I like Harry Styles this much? How could someone with as many photos of Harry Styles saved to her iPhone's camera roll as I had not want to end up with, barring the very small likelihood of Harry himself, at least a man? I could so vividly imagine being held by him, squeezed by him, picked up and carried over that threshold. Sure, I kind of blanked on what should happen after that, but that was only because I didn't have enough experience. When I came out to Kiara, I told her that I still didn't know what exactly I was. I said I was actively talking to girls on dating apps, but that I was confused because I still loved Harry Styles more than anyone. This conversation happened on GChat, where Kiara had the annoying but endearing habit of typing only a word or two before hitting enter, such that each sentence is split into several lines. She wrote, I mean, Harry Styles kind of dot 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 looks like dot 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 a lesbian. I laughed. She was not wrong. And I hope I'm not mistaken, but I have this feeling that if Harry Styles was to read this book, just let me have this dream, and he saw what Kiara and I had said about him here, he would be flattered. Why shouldn't he be? Lesbians are hot. So is Harry Styles. I saw One Direction for the second and final time in August 2015 in New Jersey as part of their On the Road Again tour. So much had changed between the first One Direction concert I went to and this one. The second time around, we had this foreboding sense, though not yet confirmed, that this could very well be the last time we ever saw the band perform. A little over a month earlier, I'd come out to my friends, and just a week after that, I'd met Lydia. On the day after our first date, at some point in the day-long texting marathon, she texted me a gif of Harry Styles. I flipped. I asked her if she knew what she was doing by sending me that gif. I didn't think I'd gushed about 1D on our date, but consuming 2 gin and tonics without dinner made me less than positive. She texted back that no, I hadn't told her how much I loved Harry or One Direction. She'd used the gif because everyone at home used to call her Styles because they had the same exact haircut and looked alike. She told me her mom sometimes texted her paparazzi photos of Harry from Us Weekly and captioned them, I thought this was you. Then she sent me a picture of herself in college to prove it, and my mouth fell open. I heard the Hallelujah chorus in my head. I had found the lesbian holy grail I hadn't even known I was searching for. A girl who looks like Harry Styles. 3 weeks later, not because of this similarity, but not in spite of it either, we were girlfriends. To what I assume was the last One Direction concert of my life, I wore a t-shirt, again made by Matt, that, at my request, said, 947 times Harry Styles and Katie Haney defined relationship goals, with BuzzFeed printed underneath in red. Lydia was a pretty good sport about it. She did not love how much I loved Harry Styles, but if I was going to harbor an infatuation with a male celebrity, better that it be for one who looked like her. If I arrived at the first concert a lukewarm, half-ironic fan, I arrived at this one a full-on 1D maniac. This time, we had much, much better seats. We were the oldest people in our section by at least 8 years, but I didn't care. I felt grateful for my age and the extra height it provided me. While we waited for the show to start, we watched roadies walk to the end of the catwalk to set things up and squealed, Oh my god, Harry is going to be that close. When the boys finally came on stage, I cried. There was this overwhelming sense of survival in their being here, despite a hard year, despite losing someone we had loved. The crowd was not just overjoyed, but grateful. It felt like we knew the end was near, but that was probably me projecting. Because I was older than almost everybody there who wasn't some preteen's dad, I was therefore slightly more aware of mortality. The girls were still hoping for their miracle to last forever. When the band played 18, one of my very favorite songs, they all held up signs, echoing the lyrics, that said, I have loved you since I was blank. Most of them said 11, 13, 14, 16. Had I gotten the memo, and I wished I had, mine would have said, I have loved you since I was 26. It is never too late. Chapter 10, What Not to Wear. 2 hours after I came out to my mom over the phone, she called me back with a follow-up question. Are you still going to wear dresses? I thought this was funny and sweet. It was funny because it was so mom, but even more so because I loved dresses. I laughed. Yes, I assured her. Of course I would still wear them. I was exactly the same person as before, right? About a month later, I flew back home to Minnesota for my 10-year high school reunion, and my mom and I went shopping. I bought a sundress that was emerald green, my favorite color. It was a little too daytime beachside barbecue for my reunion, but I texted a picture of me wearing it to Lydia, and she texted back a series of heart eyes emojis, so I decided to buy it anyway. I packed it into my suitcase, flew back to Brooklyn, and hung it up in my closet, where it remained, untouched, for more than a year. I've worn a dress a few times since then, to a fundraiser cocktail party in muggy early September, on some other ordinary day too hot to consider allowing fabric to touch my inner thighs. But somehow, at some point, without realizing that a shift was taking place until it was complete, something horrible happened. It proved my mother right. I stopped wanting to wear dresses. I was not exactly the same person as before. I didn't really notice anything was up until fall came, and suddenly one of my favorite easy workday looks, a sweater over a skirt with tights and boots, no longer appealed to me. Something just looked off. All my skirts were too poofy, and the dresses hung lifelessly off my body. I looked too girly. As someone who, at least until then, liked to look somewhat girly, at least some of the time, someone who regularly browsed Anthropologie's sales section, who'd pictured Kevin Costner's wife's giant, billowing wedding dress as the platonic ideal of wedding dresses since 2004, this was disorienting to me. I chalked it up to the normal ups and downs of dressing oneself, vowing to try the offending outfit again a few days later. But then that day would come, and it still didn't look or feel right. It was a strange feeling to miss my dresses as they hung, unharmed and available, in my closet. The only thing stopping me from wearing them was me. I wished I still wanted to wear them, but I didn't. I didn't want new ones for a long time, either, and because of that, an entire window of shopping possibility was closed on me. It wasn't just dresses and skirts, either. I lost entire stores. My internet browser's search bar still auto-filled the names of former favorites. Madewell, H&M, J.Crew, Loft. All the places I'd almost always been able to find something I wanted. But after I stopped looking at their dresses, I noticed myself losing interest in their other clothes, too. Suddenly it all looked so heterosexual. Maybe it's silly to grieve my lost appreciation for mass market retailers, but not knowing where to shop made me sad, because I love to shop. I was not looking to adopt some sort of Marie Kondo-esque Zen state in which I accepted simplicity and minimalism into my life. I would have preferred to have a shit ton of clothes I loved. I would have preferred to be so overwhelmed by choice that I had to plan my outfits in advance. In my senior year of high school, my best friend and I had a competition to see who could go the longest into the year without repeating an outfit. She won, but I made it into early November. After I came out, my clothing overwhelmed me, for sure, but not because there was too much of it to choose from. I felt overwhelmed by opening my closet and seeing clothes I couldn't even remember wanting. I felt overwhelmed when I ran my hand over the soft silk of my dresses and wondered whether I should donate them or keep them, just in case I changed again. I was overwhelmed by the pervasive sense of in-betweenness I felt. Not yet ready to let go, unsure how to move forward. After a lifetime of feeling left out of my friends' dating conversations by my perpetual singleness, I'd looked forward to getting all caught up and included once I got into a relationship of my own. Then I realized, I'll never be caught up. I'll never have experienced teenage love, and I'll never have had the kind of sexy early 20s hijinks so many of my friends had. I entered my first relationship at 28, and it was with a woman, and almost all my friends are straight. And it's not completely different, but it's different enough. I've talked about guys with my friends all my life, but in coming out I felt I'd waived the extremely small amount of street cred I had. And most of the queer friends I'd made had all been out much longer than I had, and around them, I didn't feel gay enough. I was suddenly underqualified for everything. So I felt adrift. Like everybody else, I was convinced I was singularly, hopelessly, particularly alone in my circumstances. There wasn't a lot to do about it apart from continuing to allow time to pass. I hoped I'd eventually lose interest in my own queerness in favor of something else, like, I don't know, artisanal bread baking. But for most of that entire first year, being gay was the most important thing about me, to me, and I was frustrated by my inability to telegraph this change through my clothing. As my identity shifted, so too did the audience I had in mind when I got dressed. While I still wanted my straight friends to think I looked great, I really, really wanted my queer friends to think I looked great. I also just wanted to look queer, at least more so. At least enough so that when I saw a pair of lesbians on the street in Brooklyn, it was possible they would look at me and recognize me as a card-carrying member of the club. While I knew that queer women can wear any style they want and be no more or less queer because of it, I also knew there were some signifiers. But my tattoos were minimal and my face unpierced. I was pretty sure I lacked the edge to pull off daytime sweatpants, and most hats just look stupid on me. If I wanted to look a little gayer at a formal event, I could wear a suit instead of a dress. But on ordinary days, which was most of them, I couldn't figure out how to look both a little gayer and like myself. When I started dating Lydia, I used to watch over her shoulder while she browsed her favorite online store on her phone. So soothing, like watching someone else play a video game you've never played and never will. First, I noticed the prices. They were suspiciously low. "Is that in American dollars?" I yelled. "Yep," she said. "Men's clothing. It's ridiculous." I watched for another couple of minutes in silence. Then, "Wait, I like that shirt." So, because it was only $8, my girlfriend bought it for me. It was a black short-sleeve t-shirt, but the crew neck was high and the sleeves long enough to roll up the way I liked. I downloaded the store's app to my own phone and began cautiously injecting a bit of menswear into my closet. It wasn't easy. For one thing, most men's clothing is boring. You just don't see a male equivalent of, like, peplum. There was a way to look cool in simple combinations of pants and t-shirts and jackets. I'd seen it done again and again on the various tomboy fashion Instagrams I followed. But I could never figure it out for myself. While it was confusing to grow disconnected from so much of the clothing I once loved, it was also exciting to imagine what might take its place. It was a slow process, which was good for my bank account, at least, and often a frustrating one. Sometimes, rudely, the things that looked cool on hot Instagram models did not look all that cool on me. Many of the things I ordered online, warily and hopefully, I returned. Successes were few, but invigorating. A hooded black spring jacket, men's, and therefore maybe the first jacket I've owned with sleeves long enough for my arms. A pair of black sneakers that went on my feet like glass slippers. If there's one thing that remained constant, it was a heavy preference for black. In the early spring after I started dating Lydia, I attempted to clean out my closet. This was something I should have done months earlier, regardless of seasonal appropriateness. It was messy, full of things I hadn't worn in ages. Getting rid of things is hard for me. When I went off to college, I nearly cried throwing out my JV tennis t-shirts, and they were sweat-stained and hideous. But you have to let go of former selves to make space for new ones. Though I was able to clean out and donate a few large garbage bags worth of clothing, I held on to the green dress through the summer, just in case. But I didn't wear it once. I didn't even think about wearing it. In the fall, when my roommate Rachel organized a clothing swap, I put my green dress up for the taking. Nobody took it. The rejection of one's clothing is always humiliating. See, every consignment experience I've ever had. But this felt almost taunting. It wasn't until December that I finally got rid of it. A coworker of mine offered to gather up Christmas clothing donations at our office, so I brought it to work and left it neatly folded in the big cardboard donation box beside her desk. But by then, something strange was happening. I was starting to like some of the old standbys again. My eyes no longer glazed over when I went to browse Madewell or H&M online. The things I liked were maybe not exactly the things I liked before, but these shifts in taste have always happened to me periodically, gay or not. I still do not feel particularly inclined toward dresses or skirts, but I no longer feel like that is due to anything more than a passing trend or whim. Not long after my men's short-sleeve button-up phase, I got really into blazers and silk blouses and skinny trousers, a look I more or less stole from How I Met Your Mother's Robin Scherbatsky and thus named the off-duty newscaster. It was structured but femme, the kind of outfit a women's magazine would call borrowed from the boys. It was not particularly fashion-forward or interesting, but I have lately come to accept that my style may never be particularly fashion-forward or interesting. Recently, I told Lydia that I was kind of over my boy clothes phase, and she smiled knowingly, which of course annoyed me. I knew what she'd say, that I'd gone through the same thing so many queer women go through when they first come out. I'd done the stereotypical baby dyke thing of buying a bunch of men's shirts and snapback hats and whatever else I saw all the Instagram lesbians wearing, and had tried in earnest to make them fit me. And then, slowly but surely, I turned back into myself. A not all that stylish copycat who vacillates between tomboy and femme depending on the day. I dyed my hair back to something like my natural medium brown from its former bleached blonde. I bought some silk shirts and a chicly, shapeless dress. I got this unexpected urge to wear heels. Just once, and I was all set again for the next year. I would have loved to come out and feel at once fully formed, somehow done as a person. For a while, I felt a real comfort in knowing that my clothing said something about the person I'd so recently become. But after a while, being capital G gay lost some of its novelty and became instead just one of the many things that make me who I am. The clothing I'd acquired in an attempt to fit a self-imposed mold, clothing I really did want, the kind of clothing I still admire on other people, started feeling as weird on my body as the green dress before it. I have given most of my wannabe tomboy costumes to Lydia, who conveniently wears the same size shirts that I do. I am trying to accept a winnowed wardrobe made up mostly of basics. After all, there has really been only one outfit that has remained equally comfortable throughout this whole process, and that is a black sweatshirt with black jeans. In this outfit, I feel as at peace as I did as a third grader in Catholic school, wearing my uniform, a navy sweatshirt over navy leggings. But even I get bored of being boring sometimes, and that is when I am most prone to pursuing a new look. Perhaps one day I will really nail it and become known for my trademark hairstyle, or glasses, or high-top tennis shoes. Until then, I will probably continue taking cues from Kristen Stewart. Girl number four. Shakira. Eighth grade through... question mark? I learned of Shakira in my eighth grade Spanish 1 class, which was my favorite class that year. Before class began, my teacher played Spanish language pop, and I always got there early to hear it. After hearing songs from Pies Descalzos so many times, I asked my teacher who sang it, and she handed me Shakira's CD to take home over the weekend so I could burn myself a copy. For the rest of middle school, it was all I listened to. With allowance money, I bought Shakira's MTV Unplugged DVD and watched her belly dance in leather pants in my family's living room, feeling vaguely embarrassed whenever my mom or dad walked through the room. For my birthday, I asked for a 2x3-foot poster of her, and when it arrived, I hung it on the wall above my dresser, where it stayed until I went off to college. Chapter 11. I Owe You. The first time I posted a picture of Lydia and me on Instagram, I instantly wondered if the strangers who followed me because of my first book would be able to tell she and I were dating. It was a selfie taken from above, the two of us lying next to each other on the floor of the American Museum of Natural History below the fiberglass giant blue whale suspended above. We are not kissing or even touching, but neither is the photo overtly platonic. So, of course they could tell. I know now that it's always obvious. But at the time, it seemed too sharp a turn for anyone to follow. Throughout the first few months of my relationship with Lydia, my dual existence as the private, present me versus the previous self I'd made public was rarely far from my mind. I knew my sexuality was something I'd have to write about and would want to write about eventually, but I was also superstitious and worried that making some huge announcement might somehow cause my relationship to fall apart. I worried about claiming a label only to end up shedding it months or years later. I worried I'd lost credibility as an authority on myself. I knew I had to say something, but I didn't want to say anything for fear of making myself inaccurate. This sense of confessional responsibility is one of the strangest things about being a semi-public figure, and I've experienced it only on a very small scale. Before I wrote my first book, nobody who didn't know me personally cared about me, as it should be. And judging by the ratio of people who contacted me about my book to people who read it, most of the latter felt it contained as much information about me as they could possibly need, if not more. But there was a subset of people who had a follow-up question for every confession I shared. Most were kind and simply curious. The emails that asked if I had found a boyfriend since writing, and if not, how I was doing. But occasionally, they went deeper. Once, a young woman messaged me on Facebook to ask if I could send her pictures of everyone I described in the book. I was shocked and offended by her nerve. The thing is, I'm a hypocrite. I found this girl's message creepy, but I once tracked down the LinkedIn page of a woman who was dating a semi-famous lesbian YouTuber so I could learn her age. I didn't know either of these people. I will probably never meet them. I don't particularly want to meet them. Their lives are not especially interesting, aside from the fact that they seem to have a lot of money. The YouTube model of fame makes me feel elderly and alien, and yet I get sucked in. I refer to them by first name. I gossip about their relationships as if I know them. so help me God, I ship. I do not think of these people as entirely real. They exist only as I know them, in snippets, through the beautifully filtered lens of Instagram. If there is a line between curious fan behavior and creepy fan behavior, it is hazy and suited to my own needs. I would never email a stranger to ask her about her divorce, but I will try to put together a timeline of her relationship's demise using her social media platforms. I arrive at the end of these information gathering sessions bewildered and embarrassed. I do not know why I care. I only know that my desire to pry is bottomless. I want to collect every sordid detail of every life that I possibly can. It is as if I think knowing more about other people's lives will preserve my own. Still, I have never wanted answers about a stranger's life so badly that I have asked the source herself. I'm too self-conscious and too proud. I couldn't bear to have anyone famous, or even sort of famous, think I care that much about them. Obviously, though, I do. What does any of us owe anyone else? I want to say nothing. Not one thing to anyone. But that would be me pretending to be much more of an individualist than I really am. Like most Catholics, former or present, I envy all hedonists. Every single one of my days is engineered toward the completion of a lifelong checklist. A lot of the time, I can't tell if I'm doing something because I think I should or because I really want to. It is depressing to think that for me, maybe, those two must always overlap. The worst part is that I'm not even religious, and so, presumably, there is no heaven waiting as a reward for all this good behavior. The fact is that I do feel as though I owe something to anyone who cares enough about me to read my books or follow me online. I wouldn't necessarily say the same must be true for other writers or artists, but if you put work into the world hoping for an audience, I think it's unreasonable to expect that relationship to remain entirely one-sided. If I didn't want to know what anyone thought of my work, I wouldn't publish it. If I didn't want people to know personal details about my life, this would be a pretty funny way of showing it. I may not have known what exactly I was in for when I published my first book, but it is only because people responded to it the way they did that I am here now. There is responsibility there, even if there are days I don't want it. So when I'd been dating Lydia for a little over 3 months, and that didn't seem likely to change anytime soon, I came out to the internet. I wrote, I have a girlfriend now. There's no reason to bury the lead, especially when it's maybe not even as much of a lead as I think it is. That, really, has been the main reason for my reticence. Part of me is like, shut up, who cares? And part of me is like, well, what if everybody does? I wrote a decently popular book about wanting and failing to date boys, and now I am dating a girl and will maybe only ever date girls. Singular or plural, who knows? If I have learned anything from the various epiphanies that have occurred to me in the nearly 2 years since my book came out, my book, in which I claim to know myself very well, it is that I am able to be certain of much less than I thought when I was a little younger than I am now. Maybe this isn't a huge contradiction like I sometimes fear. Reactions to my news have been almost disappointingly nonchalant. I kept telling my therapist, I feel like there should have been more crying. An interrogation, at least. Instead, most everyone I've told was like, huh. And then they were like, huh. Telling strangers is different, though, both easier and more overwhelming. Easier because I do not necessarily care what any one of them thinks, but more overwhelming in that, together, they are a much larger group than people who know me personally. If one girl who read my book and felt we were the same, even though that was never all the way true because no two people are, was to now feel disappointed to find out we are not, I would perhaps feel a tiny loss, but I would be fine. If many of them were to feel that way, I would feel that I had let a group of people I care about down. I wanted to be a role model, sort of, and then I think I was, and it has been both gratifying and strange. Now I just want to be myself again. I told my therapist I wanted there to be two me's, one for myself, who can keep everything in some protected real-life bubble, and another for strangers, to carry on as the Katie they believe they know. This is all obviously narcissistic. Two of me! I'm practically making myself throw up. Or, I guess what I want is for there to still be someone like the me I presented in that book. Unlucky in hetero love, but plucky and resilient and optimistic about what her future looks like, so that the girls who need her still have her. Because I get that. I wanted that. I always wanted to see some version of me who was living my life, the outline of it, at least, but 3 or 4 years ahead, so I could know that I was normal and okay and that I'd be happy. When I was younger, I looked for a straight girl, still single, but happy, at 20 or 25 or 30. And later, I looked for a queer girl who didn't know until late, in all the same ways I didn't and then did, and I never found either one. Now I know that's because neither of them is really there. I'm not exactly that girl for anyone else, either, and I'm sorry. Not because I want to be any different, but because I know what it's like to feel alone. Probably my biggest fear is that girls who felt less alone because of my book will now feel it seeping back, even though that was never really in my power to prevent. My second biggest fear is that people will look from my book to me now and back again and go, oh, well, that's why. I don't think it's that simple. I told the truth as best I could, and now the truth is a little bigger. I've been going back and forth for a while on whether I should say something about this in a more public sense, because I am pretty much constantly torn between wanting to never write about my personal life ever again and wanting to do only that. And I expect this push and pull to continue for basically the rest of my annoying life. But as much as I'm nagged by these fears about vague, hypothetical complications resulting from my book and my online persona and the ways I have changed and will continue to change, I'm much more bothered by the idea of not saying something online simply because I am afraid. It is very likely that there is a more thoughtful way to say most of this, but I'm beginning to think that thoughtfulness can be overdone, and that after a certain amount of time spent thinking and thinking and thinking things over, it might be better to just finally say the thing you've been wondering if you should say and see what happens next. I didn't know exactly what to expect when I came out online. I tried to publish that post before I could think about it too much. I was afraid that people would think I was a hypocrite or a liar or an idiot. I didn't want the many kind people who'd read my first book and told me I mattered to them to now decide that I didn't. I didn't want people telling me I should have known sooner. I hate uncertainty, and I really hate being late, and here I was, guilty of both. But as is usually the case, I shouldn't have spent so much time worrying. The responses were so overwhelmingly supportive that even now, more than 2 years later, I find it hard to articulate how much they mean to me. I'd struggled to explain how I'd changed so much in such a short time, and women I didn't even know were there to tell me there was no explanation necessary. They told me it made sense. That I made sense. My story didn't have to fit inside anyone's expectations because it wasn't, first and foremost, a story. It was my life. My first book was true. So is this one. People want a clear narrative arc, especially me. We want gay adults to have gay childhoods, the elementary school crushes, the closeted adolescence, the gradual coming to terms. We want a line, no breaks, no swerving, from point A to point B. But I broke and I swerved plenty. I feel behind, but I truly didn't know how to get here any quicker. I didn't even know where I was trying to go. In every moment leading up to this one, at ages 9 and 14 and 19 and 26, I have been as close to myself as I knew how to be. I may know myself better now than I ever have before, but ask me again in a year or two. Chapter 12, Introvert Problems. The first time I was prescribed an anti-anxiety medication, I was at the tail end of a 3-week frantic hypochondria episode during which I convinced myself I had both a heart condition and elephantiasis of the foot. The foot thing is a long story, or at least it seemed grounded in a long and plausible medical history to me at the time. I'd had some problems with it in college, some off and on pain and swelling, which I chalked up to my illustrious career as a Division III tennis team bench warmer. It went away, but then, a few years later, bored at the office where I was working as a summer policy intern, I looked at my feet beneath my desk and noticed one of them was fat. I spun out very quickly from there. Within hours, I was on web forums and self-diagnosing. Within days, I was ordering obscure supplements meant to relieve inflammation off the internet. I took my own pulse 20 times a day, convinced my heart was about to beat out of my chest. I was pretty sure my foot would need to be amputated. I knew I was experiencing anxiety, but I also believed I was gravely ill, because there was no way anxiety alone could make me feel this bad. I told my supervisor I needed to finish my internship from home. I kept developing new symptoms. My entire left side started to tingle. On top of everything else, I was having a multi-day stroke. One night, around 4 a.m., I called the nurse helpline on the back of my insurance card to ask if she thought I should go to the ER. Among other diagnostics, she told me to pick up a cup with my left hand. If it didn't fall to the floor, she said, I probably wasn't having a stroke. I walked into my bathroom and picked up my blue ceramic toothbrush holder and held on for dear life. But even when it didn't fall,